From WAMU 88.5 at American University in Washington, welcome to the Politics Hour, starring Tom Sherwood. I'm Kojo Nandi. Later in the broadcast, we'll be joined by Bruce DePoit, who is a former senior reporter for Maryland Matters. He witnessed the inauguration of the governor and lieutenant governor of Maryland. He will talk about that. Tom Sherwood is our resident analyst and contributing writer for Washington City Paper. Tom Sherwood, welcome.
Hello, everybody.
Joining us now in studio is Brooke Pinto. She is a D.C. council member representing Ward 2. Brooke Pinto, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me. Great to be here.
Tom Sherwood, a couple of topics I'd like to talk about before we get to the district in particular, but Brooke Pinto, feel free to join this part of the conversation. The relationship between Metro and the Washington Metro Rail Safety Commission, a relationship that was not good to begin with, but seems now to be deteriorating even farther to the point where they're requesting outside mediation. What's going on?
Well, the Metro Rail Safety Commission was created about 5 or 6 years ago by Congress and local officials because there were too many safety issues with Metro. And they, in fact, have worked together pretty well. But now that the Metro system is particularly trying to get the 7,000 series cars back on the tracks and improve service on the new Silver Line and other places, the Metro Rail Safety Commission has been still asking questions about the training of the operators and the safety of the cars and the wheels. And Metro is complaining now, Metro officials are complaining, that the Safety Rail Commission, rather than being a partner in safety, is taking more of a gotcha, finding things to complain about and stopping some of the improvement Metro wants. That kind of tension, of course, is not good. And so both Charles Allen, who's the new chairman of the Committee on Transportation in the council here in the district, and in Maryland, the officials there want these two sides to come to public hearings and air their grievances so they can get back on the same page.
The airing of the grievances. I thought that holiday had passed, but that's a whole other story.
It's every Friday at noon.
In Alexandria, there are school resource officers, and there was some pushback against them at some point, but now there is an advisory group that says that the school resource officer should remain in Alexandria schools.
This is a recalculation of a number of local governments about the use of school officers police officers in schools. Montgomery County is reconsidering it. They've changed the name and going to change how it's done. Alexandria, a committee of teachers and parents and students, said they want them back in some kind of fashion. The issue is you don't want police officers marching down school hallways, interfering in disciplinary actions that result in arrests, often of minority students and others. So Alexandria wants to change it. Montgomery wants to change it. We'll ask our guest in a moment about the district, because the district has voted to remove school officers by 2025. One of the council members, Trayon White from Ward 8, is opposing that, but we'll talk about that. But the issue is, how do you have police officers around the school system where they can support teachers and administrations, but don't criminalize students for behavior that is not necessarily worth the police getting involved? It's a balance, and we haven't found it yet.
Well, you said we'd talk about that with our guest in a moment. The moment has arrived, Brooke Pinto. Tom Sherwood, do you have a specific question for her about this?
Well, the council has voted in the last year or so, I think last year, to remove school resource officers as of 2025, I believe. You're the new chair of the Judiciary Public Safety Committee. We'll ask you about that in a moment, but where do we stand in the district on school resource officers? And welcome.
Thank you very much. Great to be here in studio. So that is correct that the council voted to phase out school resource officers from schools by 2025. I did not vote for that move. Neither did my Ward 7 colleague, Vince Gray, my Ward 8 colleague, Trayon White, my then Ward 3 colleague, Mary Che, and others. And what I continue to hear from students, school leaders, and teachers is that in the schools where we're seeing the most violence, they really need some additional help and they need some additional security. And so I'm going to continue being responsive to members of the community that I hear from. And I am very open to taking another look at how we can get our schools the security they need. And school resource officers is one way to do so.
You agree that the police officers shouldn't be an occupying force, that you have to, there has to be, it had to be melded in with discipline in the schools, teaching students more about public safety themselves. All those things have to be included. It can't just be police officers walking down the halls.
Absolutely. And these are our kids. One of the things that we saw with the SROs, and we're continuing to see, is because the resources are relatively slim, they're rotating among a few different school communities. And I think it's really important that they become part of the school communities, that they know the parents, that they know the students, they know the teachers and the school leadership, so that they can really be a part of improving public safety and not just responding to these terrible incidents that we continue to see harming our children.
Yeah, I know that Trayon White, during the debates on this, the council member from Ward 8 said, I've been in these schools. Some of these guys are very scary and tough, and we need to have some support for the students who need the support and would like to see the officers there. But again, an ongoing battle.
Another issue that has some relevance to the District of Columbia, though not in the same kind of context, and that is there are about 1,700 vehicles with license plates in Virginia that honor Robert E. Lee. And, of course, they're taking down everything Robert E. Lee in Virginia right now. And so there's a move to get rid of those license plates, too.
Well, yes, you know, in our jurisdiction, in the district, and pretty much everywhere locally, there are various, you can have personalized license plates. And in Virginia, there are something like 1,700 people who have some kind of Robert E. Lee license tag. And given the movement to remove the monuments in Richmond and other places and to rename the streets or some of the highways in Virginia and minimize or eliminate the Civil War references, this is just one more step in that.
In the District of Columbia, the issue is the temporary license plates that we see on what seems to be more and more vehicles.
Yeah, this isn't, maybe we'll get an answer from our guest here, but you see all these temporary license plates and there just seems to be an explosion of them, and I'm just wondering why.
It's very troubling to see, and we have to do more to make sure that our transportation agencies and our Metropolitan Police Department are able to enforce these tags. A, they are illegal, and sometimes we see other problematic behavior associated with drivers who have these illegal tags. And so it's certainly something we're going to be looking at on the Judiciary Committee and hopefully partnering with my Ward 6 colleague, Charles Allen, who's the chair of the Transportation Committee, on getting these enforcement mechanisms right. We've also tripled the funding for our booting and impoundment team to try to increase the enforcement that we can do on some of these illegal vehicles.
But at the same time, the council has passed legislation that no matter how much you owe in parking tickets and fines, you can still renew your license and your tag. Seems to be inconsistent.
I will say I am not supportive of removing all types of enforcement for violations on your driver's license, and it's something that we're looking at getting that balance right in the coming year.
That's the voice of Brooke Pinto, in case you're just joining us. Shame on you, but you're forgiven. Let's start again with your new assignment as chair of the Judiciary and Public Safety Committee. Was this your first choice for a chairmanship?
You know, I hear every day from residents in Ward 2 and across the city that public safety is the first thing on their minds. And it is the first thing on my mind every day as I work on behalf of district residents. And so I think this is a huge opportunity, and I take the responsibility really seriously to have oversight of this committee and to try to make some serious improvements when it comes to public safety and reducing gun violence that is far too prevalent in our city right now.
So it wasn't your first choice. Anyway.
This is a prime time to say the council this week voted to override the mayor's veto of the crime code revision. It took several years to get it in place. The mayor said she agreed with about 95% of it. But she vetoed it because she thought some of the penalties were reduced and there's some strain on judges owned trials, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. You voted to override the mayor's veto, even though you said you would, you had your own concerns. Do you have anything that you're going to be bringing back to the council soon, or is this a long-term project? What did you object to in the Crime Revision Commission?
I do, and thanks for raising this, because I think this is really important that your listeners understand what's going on here and what is not going on here with the revision of the criminal code. Our criminal code was written in 1901 and has not been significantly modified or modernized since. There are still things in the criminal code that outlaw playing cards in the street or what was called being a common scold, which is being a pain to your neighbor. So the vast majorities of the United States, of the states in the United States, did a similar modernization 50 years ago. This was just kind of common sense updates and making the code proportionate and rational, which makes things much easier for prosecutors, victims, defendants, and judges, which is why even opponents of the bill agree with 95% of what this bill does. Which
that
is
would
really,
be Mayor Bowser, but go ahead.
Which is really right, making it modern, proportional, and rational. And so as the bill went through its process, there was 16 years ago, a commission was set up. There were dozens and dozens of meetings. The commission sent their recommendations to the council. We had three hearings on those recommendations. I had a public safety meeting last fall, and I continued to hear from residents about concerns they had with certain pieces of the recommendations, concerns that they wanted to make sure that carjacking was a standalone offense, which we did, that they wanted mandatory minimums for first-degree murder, which we did, that they wanted to maintain criminal liability for public defecation or urination on the street or public nuisance laws, which we did. So all of those inclusions were added back in. But in the fall, I was still concerned about the penalties as it related to gun-related offenses for illegal possession of a firearm or a felon in possession of a firearm. Again, the highest value of this revision is to make sure that all of our penalties are an ordinal consequence, meaning if you do one thing that is worse than the thing below it, the penalty is higher. And so I thought as it relates to gun-related offenses, it wasn't where it should be. I introduced an amendment which failed 3-10. One of the people who voted for that amendment was Mary Che, who's no longer on the council, and the other was Vince Gray, our Ward 7 colleague. So ultimately, this revision passed unanimously from the council twice. This does not go into effect until 2025. And as the chairwoman of the Judiciary and Public Safety Committee, I am absolutely committed to looking at these penalties, to looking at the gun-related offenses in particular, to making sure that our police have the resources and training they need to learn these new laws, and to make sure that our courts are well-resourced to handle the increase of jury demandable trials.
When you say looking at, Twitter account Potomac Fever tweeted, how does Councilmember Pinto think she will be able to amend the criminal code rewrite? She lost all leverage by not fixing the issues before the veto override.
So as the chairwoman of the Committee on Judiciary, that is part of my obligation to bring my colleagues along with me in this effort to make sure that we're bringing more of them to the table so I can articulate my concerns, so we can hear from the mayor about her concerns, the U.S. attorney, the police chief, and others about changes that need to happen. The veto vote was just about voting for the veto. There was no opportunities to look at the underlying bill. And so that was not the appropriate mechanism to change a small part of the bill and throw all of that good work for modernization, which is really going to make our code much more sensible.
So as chairman of the Public Safety Committee, you can orchestrate these conversations and maybe bring up changes to the law before it goes into effect. Now, will the law go into effect at all? Already on Capitol Hill in the House, which is controlled by Republicans now, Kentucky Representative James Comer has said he'll try to block this entire revision because he's, you know, letting criminals out on the street. Somebody involved in this entire process called me up this morning and pointed out that in Kentucky, there's a carjacking law that with maximum sentence is 20 years. In the district, it'll be 24 years. So they were saying maybe the Mr. Comer should focus on the laws in his own state before he starts picking on us. But it does, as you know, crime across the city is an issue. Even though many crime elements are down, there's great concern about crimes, shootings, carjacks, and all of that. We had the mayor on a couple of weeks ago. I said around the Capital One Center, which is your ward, that the ownership of the Wizards and Capitals are concerned about the atmosphere around the Capital One Center. Do you share that concern?
And we got this from Barbara by email. I'm sure you saw that the movie theater in Chinatown is closing. That would be the Regal Theaters there. There is constant drug dealing and a general sense of lawlessness in this area to the point where I don't feel safe enjoying any of the amenities at night. What is your plan to make Chinatown safe?
Can we just point out that center, that movie theater complex, I think 14 screens, mm-hmm. is closing along with a number of movie screens around the country. That company is like in bankruptcy or something. But there is a concern about there, and people would not go to those theaters.
Well, thank you so much. There was a lot there, so I'm trying to get speak as quickly as I can. So
30 seconds
comes
or less.
To carjacking, that is a really good example because we have too much carjacking in our city, and it is absolutely unacceptable. Currently, 97.5% of carjacking cases are sentenced to 15 years or less. The revised criminal code has a maximum of 24 years. So this rhetoric around penalties being reduced for these really serious violent crimes is just inaccurate. It's not what this code is doing, and it's really important that the public understands that.
And there are also a lot of the carjackings are done by juveniles, which is a wholly different set of laws, which the revision doesn't touch.
That's exactly right. This revision is for adult crimes. In terms of Republicans intervening in our affairs in the District of Columbia, it was not the first time and it won't be the last. We need DC statehood to make sure that we can manage our own affairs. Again, this revision is not the boogeyman it is made out to be. It is an unsexy modernization of our criminal code that makes things sensible and in line. And so I hope that the Republicans stay out of our affairs because we have been studying this issue for quite some time. I do want to get to Barbara's question about Capital One Arena and safety down in Chinatown. This has been a major issue for me as the Ward 2 council member and absolutely as the chairwoman of the Committee on Judiciary and Public Safety. We've done a lot of things to try to intervene in crime here. I'm trying to get a new police substation located in Chinatown to respond more quickly to incidents of crime. We've been working with the police on changing their rotation. What we were seeing around Gallery Place Metro is that many people were setting up very early in the day with lawn chairs and other things. And so we changed the schedule of the First District Police so that they would arrive earlier in the morning to prevent that from happening. I recently did a bike ride with our First District officers. I did this as well with 2D and 3D to get a sense of what they're seeing in the community. I've been meeting with the U.S. Attorney, the Chief of Police, about prioritization for this area because it is really concerning the crime that we continue to see here.
Ted, the reason part of this is Ted Leonsis, who owns the Wizards and the Caps, wants to do a major redo of the Capital One Center, change the outside of it, make it more interactive. One council member I spoke to said there's even suggestion of maybe closing some of the streets around the Capital One Center to make it more of a destination place and not a transportation hub. So, although there's a metro stop right there, but something needs to be done. It can't just stay like it is.
Definitely. And the Capital One Arena and Monumental Sports have been excellent partners in bringing people, DC residents and visitors to Chinatown to enjoy games and concerts and other things. And I'm really looking forward to a continued partnership with them to bring more retail and people downtown, which is a big part of our plan this year for downtown recovery.
Here is Edward in Southeast Washington. Edward, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Yeah, hi. Thank you so much for taking my call. I'll try to make it quick. So my question, I guess, is on the equity of traffic cameras. Just a real quick backstory. So I just moved back to D.C. about a year ago. I live at Crescent Skyland in southeast across the river, and I didn't realize D.C. had traffic cameras, and they were sending the bills or tickets to my old address. And so when the person that lived there now handed me, I had like 12 and I'm sorry, I'm a really safe driver. I didn't stop all the way, and I incurred like close to $2,000 in traffic cameras, or in tickets. And so, and the point is too, how you all were saying earlier with all the temp tags. I mean, I've heard.
Okay, but you got to get to a question.
Does it make sense? I know they're installing more cameras. Does it make equitable sense to go about it that way? Because a lot of people are just driving around with, say, temp tags to avoid the traffic cameras. Thank you.
And those rolling stops will get you a ticket every time. But go ahead, please.
Well, thank you for that question. And I think what you're getting at is the frustration that a lot of DC residents feel, which is, I'm a law-abiding citizen and I am getting these tickets and these exorbitant fines, and I'm looking over and there's somebody with a temporary tag who's not being enforced. And many of those people are coming in from other states. And I agree with you there, and that's where the priority should be. One of the things that we're trying to do, I introduced a bill yesterday on vehicular noise and to use cameras to similarly take photographs of cars that are in making excessive volume with their vehicles. And one of the pieces that we included, to your point around equity, is to make sure that there's a subsidy available to people to fix their car if it's, you know, an old car or making excessive noise. And so we're trying to have equity at the forefront of all of our traffic-related interventions moving forward. But we will definitely be taking a look to make sure that the fine schedule is fair.
I think people should pay their tickets, but I want to point out that if you, there's no enforcement. If you can go online and put somebody's tag in, see they owe $10,000, $15,000 in tickets. The city has no enforcement, and now you can get a license. That used to be a way you couldn't register your car, and you couldn't get a driver's license if you had outstanding tickets. That's no longer the case. So, in fact, as of right now, there's no reason, if you have a ticket, to pay it.
Earlier this month, a D.C. resident shot and killed 13-year-old Karan Blake in Brookland. The person apparently is a D.C. government employee, allegedly saw Karan Blake trying to break into cars. You saw the officer body camera footage from when the police arrived on the scene following the incident. What has your response been generally to this incident? Is there any other information that you can share with us?
Well, the community is rightly outraged that Karan Blake was shot and killed, 13-year-old boy in our city. I did request to see the body-worn camera footage of the responding officer who arrived on the scene, and I did have a chance to watch that footage. Unfortunately, so as not to undermine the investigation that's ongoing, I'm not permitted to talk about the substance of that footage, but my primary focus is to hold MPD and the U.S. Attorney's Office accountable and make sure that they can move expeditiously to a charging decision so that the public can get some answers, and that so Karan Blake's family can get some answers.
Yeah, there's
but
a lot
of course,
of information.
We can never bring him back.
Excuse me. There's a lot of information about the 13-year-old. There's uncertainty about what was happening. What I find unusual is it seems like this is an incident that happened at 4 o'clock in the morning. A 13-year-old is shot. Somebody's come out and either confronted. We don't know. It seems to me too much time has passed and that we ought to have known something more. I thought that grand jury was going to meet this week and there might be an indictment or not an indictment. It seems to me, I don't understand why it's taking so long. Mm-hmm. I can understand not, as the chief said, shooting your mouth off about what you don't know anything about, but it certainly does seem to be taking a long time.
Well,
it's
not
encouraging.
I'm hopeful a decision will be made very soon. I think one of the reasons for delays is the need to collect additional camera footage that may be available from the street.
Okay.
Before you go, and our time is drawing near, but we're going to ask you to stick around after the break for a little while so we'll be able to get some more questions. But here is Nick in D.C. Nick, your turn.
I understand that you introduced a bill this week to give rebates to purchases of e-bikes to encourage more people to ride in the bike lanes, which for most people are observing are not being used, and apparently that's your opinion too. What I'm reading is that New York City, not to mention Amsterdam, Paris, and Los Angeles, are complaining that the bike accidents are going up because of e-bikes and e-scooters, and that the e-bikes are susceptible to fires, that they explode because they're being charged wrong. So What do you have to say about the
You're not the only person who's been reading that. Jeff sent us an email who says 200 fires were started by e-bike batteries in New York, according to an article in The Guardian. Please hold your response, Councilmember Pinto, because we've got to take a short break. When we come back, we'll continue this conversation with Brooke Pinto. She's the council member representing Ward 2. I'm Kojo Namdi. Welcome back. We'll soon be joined by Bruce DePoit, who is a freelance contributor for Maryland Matters, to talk about what's going on in Maryland in the wake of the inauguration of the governor and lieutenant governor. But still with us in studio because, well, we have some more questions for her and we refuse to allow her to leave, is Brooke Pinto, the D.C. council member representing Ward 2. Councilmember Pinto, when we went to that break, there were questions about the safety of e-bikes.
Well, thank you, Kojo, and I'd be happy to stay here with you all day.
Uh-oh. Our predecessor was the same way. So go ahead, please.
We're not providing lunch.
Exactly.
So, Nick, thank you for your question about electric bikes. So, first, we have over 100 miles of bike lane infrastructure in Washington, D.C. And one of my primary goals here is to make sure that those lanes are accessible to the broadest audience as possible. And electric bikes are a way to do so, to allow biking for people of all abilities, of all ages, and has been really an effective way at reducing car trips in other places like Rhode Island and Denver that have tried similar rebate programs. The other piece to this is I really wanted to support our local small businesses in DC that have really suffered through the pandemic, which is why these rebates are only available to local DC bike shops. And in terms of the batteries, I have similarly gotten some concerns about this in the last couple of days, and we've flagged it to the Transportation Committee, and there is a different type of battery that has been proposed that is considered much more safe. And so I'm very open-minded to making sure that those batteries are adopted.
Let me get back to a crime question. There's a debate about whether we need more police, or mayor wants more police, or just better policing with the police we have. The chief wants more. The mayor wants more. The council has not approved any but replacement officers, a few dozen. You're the new chair of the Judiciary Public Safety Committee. How many police officers do you think we need? And two, Auditor Kathy Patterson is doing a study of how many officers we may need. Where are you on more police officers? Well, I would like to say better police officers, but more police officers. More or less?
So what I hear from residents every single day and from our police officers is there are not enough resources to adequately be out of cars,
resources
on foot.
Meaning officers?
Resources meaning officers. Okay. And that's part of the reason I did these bike rides this fall with all of our police officers in 1st District, 2nd District, and 3rd District to see what it is they're seeing on the street and to see how the expansion of their bike patrols are going, which has been a great effort under Chief Conte's leadership. I will also say I'm looking forward to seeing the results of the staffing study, but because we're the nation's capital, our police officers are drawn upon all the time to handle protests and First Amendment assemblies and visitors from all over the world.
Motorcades.
And as a result, they're pulled from our neighborhoods. And so it's really important that our police force has the officers they need to keep all of us safe in our neighborhoods.
When Charles Allen chaired the Judiciary Committee, things could get a little tense between him, the mayor, the police chief, and the public. It's a stressful job, and you'll never make anyone happy. But first, what's your relationship like with Mayor Bowser?
So I have a lot of respect for Mayor Bowser. I think that she and I share a lot of the same goals, particularly around improving public safety for district residents, focusing on downtown recovery and revitalization, and ensuring that our neighbors who are experiencing homelessness can be moved into stable and affordable housing. And I have a very productive working relationship with her and hope that that continues. And also have a responsibility as the chair of the Judiciary Committee to engage in meaningful oversight of the agencies and making sure that the investments that the council has made are being executed responsibly and effectively.
Let me ask you a raw political question for the Politics Hour. This week, the council had a ceremonial resolution to honor Carl Racine for his 8 years as first elected attorney general. 12 of you approved it again for the council, and Kenyon McDuffie took it off the agenda. And so you're not going to give this ceremonial resolution to Carl Racine. you worked for Carl Racine. What do you think about the political act by your colleague, Mr. McDuffie, to bar him from being honored?
Well, Carl Racine, as our first elected attorney general, has done an unbelievably fantastic job on behalf of district residents, not only supporting our most vulnerable residents, but also in how he led the office.
Excuse me, that's what the resolution says. What about the fact that your colleague, Mr. did you speak to McDuffie about it?
It is a resolution that should absolutely move forward. I have not spoken to my colleagues about it.
Okay, just before you go, here is Jay in Washington, D.C. Jay, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Yeah, Ms. Pinto, D.C. law requires equal pay for equal work for its employees, but the recent teacher deal, 1,000 or more of those teachers are not going to get their retroactive pay because they may have since died or contracted some disease and had to leave or taken care of elderly parents or any of a number of other reasons. And that's because of an obscure provision that says you still have to be on the payroll as of the time the council approves the deal, which you haven't even gotten it yet. Would you support getting rid of that particular provision and pay all those teachers?
As former school board member Jay Silberman, the fact is if you've left the school system while this contract was being agreed to, you don't get the retroactive money.
Well, thank you, Jay, and thank you so much for your service on the school board. Our teachers deserve fair pay, and they deserve serious respect, and it's definitely something that I am happy to take a look at to make sure that they are honored as they should be.
And I'm afraid that's all the time we have with Brooke Pinto, the D.C. council member representing Ward 2. She has a date in the ring with some guy named McDuffie sometime. No, I was just joking about it. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me. Have a great weekend.
Joining us now is Bruce DePoit. He is a freelance contributor for Maryland Matters and a longtime journalist covering our region. Bruce DePoit, thank you so much for joining us.
Kojo, it's a pleasure as always. Good to hear your voice.
I thought we said goodbye to him.
I thought so too, but he keeps...
Listeners may know that, a couple of...
We had a big farewell, yes.
Farewell, you moved into Rehoboth, but you were at the inauguration, one of the most historic events in Maryland.
Before we get there, another issue that Bruce would be interested in, because he also covered D.C. and Maryland and Virginia. What's going on with Senator Tim Kaine? Is he going to run or is he done?
Big news this morning for the last 48 hours. There's all this excitement that he was going to have a news conference today and didn't know whether he was going to bow out after two terms in the Senate. Democrats were really worried because he's an important member of the majority there. He announced this morning he's going to run for a third term, and Democrats across the state and across the country are breathing a great sigh of relief.
That's right. Bruce DePoit, care to comment on that?
It has a lot of impact on the Senate. I mean, Tim Kaine has to win a third term, highly likely, but not a foregone conclusion. But if he returns to the Hill, if he returns to the Senate, he's someone who has conversations and relationships across the aisle. He's something of a bridge between Democrats and Republicans. There aren't as many people who served that role as there perhaps used to be. So it's a significant moment, his decision to seek re-election. And if he gets there, if he gets a third term, it's a big deal actually for the Senate as well, beyond just who represents Virginia.
And one of the reasons Bruce DePoit is here today is that he was at the inauguration of Wes Moore as the governor of Maryland. There was one very recognizable voice at that inauguration.
Hello, Maryland!
That individual used to work in television in Baltimore at one point. That's, of course, the voice of Oprah Winfrey. Bruce DePoit, what was the energy like at that inauguration?
Unlike anything I've ever experienced, you had some national reporters there. You had folks like Chelsea Clinton and Oprah Winfrey, Eric Holder there. But sort of beyond all of that was the obvious sense of history that Wes Moore represents. He is the first black governor in Maryland history. He's only the third person elected governor in modern American history. David Paterson of New York ascended to the post. So there have been four, and then others from a long time ago, a couple of others from a long time ago. America does not elect black people to serve as governor. That's obvious. Wes Moore is 44. He has the sort of resume that makes me want to get back in bed and pull the sheets up over my head in embarrassment. The expectations that surround him are off the charts. And it's you've got a General Assembly, you've got a political power structure in Annapolis that is heavily invested in his success. So we are in a very different place than we have been over the past 8 years.
I watched the event on TV. It was very good. I would give it an A+ for its theatrics, its the way it was done. I thought the MC from Anne Arundel County talked too much, but I've been accused of that myself. But I thought that was really
good. Well, let the record show that Tom Sherwood and I did not talk too much at the inauguration or the swearing in of the mayor and D.C. council, and we brought the event in half an hour ahead of schedule.
As a journalist, kudos. My concern is, I've expressed to some of his people, is that since he was known to be going to win since summer, he's been very shy on the facts of things he wants to do. It's been aspirational, inspirational, but not detailed. Now, today, within this hour, the budget is supposed to be released, his budget. Have you had even yet a chance to look at it, Bruce, to see what's in there? Some specifics on raising the minimum wage, a program for high school seniors to do a year of service in the state, those types of things?
I have not had a chance to look at the budget, which I think the briefing on that is taking place as we speak. My colleague from Maryland Matters, Danielle Gaines, will be all over the budget news as no one else probably will be. To your other point, on his first full day in office, Governor Moore signed an executive order creating a Department of Service and Civic Engagement. They're going to implement his service year option for high school graduates. But I think what Wes Moore decided, as anyone in his shoes would have decided, and that is that there's one governor at a time, and that until you have the ability to do anything, you speak in broad terms, you talk about your goals, and then you lay out the specifics as you get in. Wes Moore had a very busy first full day, releasing nearly $70 million in funds that had been authorized by the General Assembly, but not actually dispersed, put into use by the former Governor Larry Hogan. This is climate money, paid family and medical leave money, cannabis reform money, and perhaps most notably, abortion training money. So it was a very busy and you could say productive first full day on the job for Wes Moore.
One of the topics that Wes Moore brought up in his address was public safety, which did get a response from the audience. Let's take a listen.
I know what it feels like to have handcuffs on my wrists.
Me too.
We're not alone. I felt that when I was 11 years old. I also know what it's like to stand with families and mourn the victims of violent crime. We do not have to choose between being a safe state and a just one. Maryland can, and we will, be both.
Bruce DePoit, as Tom Sherwood pointed out, he spoke in largely broad terms during his address, but was there anything else that stood out to you in particular?
Well, I think this issue of crime, it is one that the public is focused on. It's an issue that Republicans raised. You could argue Republicans have raised the issue of crime a lot more in the lead up to the election than they have since, candidly. But this is an issue where it will be interesting to watch Governor Moore move forward, because primarily, public safety is a local government responsibility. Yes, we have a Maryland State Police, but they're not in the neighborhoods. Governor Moore did not run to be mayor of Baltimore, county executive of Baltimore County. He is governor of the state. How he makes concrete his pledge to have both a safe and an equitable law enforcement system in the state of Maryland is going to be fascinating to watch because, again, he's not a mayor or a county executive or a local police chief. So this is one where his relationships and his advocacy, I think, are going to come to the fore, and we'll see what kind of results he can produce.
Well, the budget is actually online now. Just looking at it for public safety, he's offering up $122 million to aid local police departments, including $17 million for Baltimore City. We've all read the stories about the issues in Baltimore. He wants more for direct local enforcement grants, victims of crime money. There's a lot here. It's a long budget. I won't start reading everything in it. But it's available now. There'll be a lot of news in the next couple of days.
Bruce, Kojo.
Go ahead.
Go ahead, Kojo. Forgive me.
I was going to ask a question about another issue. If you'd like to comment on the budget, go right ahead.
Well, no, what I was going to say is having covered Annapolis since the days when William Donald Schaefer was governor, there are folks around who've covered this state politics longer than I have. But just thinking about the period that I've been blessed to observe, Wes Moore is not the first person to come into office with high expectations. For folks who remember William Donald Schaefer, he was America's mayor before anyone had really ever heard of Rudy Giuliani. Martin O'Malley was a young, handsome,
up-and-comer.
Up-and-comer, thank you, who took office in 2006, 2007. And so we've sort of, in some ways, there are parallels to the Wes Moore moment. But having said that, Wes Moore, who again has this resume, who's multiple people have observed, sort of seems like he was hatched in a lab because he does seem so perfect, comes in with a weight of expectations that I don't think any of his modern predecessors have experienced. And I think that's going to bear close watching going forward, because he has the charisma, he's has a reputation for being so well prepared, and he hits the ground with a really broad and ambitious agenda.
What part of that applies to Aruna Miller, who was sworn in as lieutenant governor, because she's another first, the first woman of color and immigrant to hold that role in Maryland, a role that is not really very prominent and doesn't seem to have to do a great deal, but what stood out to you about her address?
This will sound superficial, but the way Wes Moore beams at Aruna Miller when she speaks, when you combine the fact that she was in the House of Delegates, she has been a transportation engineer for Montgomery County government, she's very much a policy wonk. You're right in that lieutenant governor's portfolios vary greatly depending on who the individuals are in the office of governor, office of LG at any given time. Wes Moore has said that Lieutenant Governor Miller will have a broad policy portfolio. And given her experience in the General Assembly, I think there's reason to take him at his word.
And what was cool about it, when she spoke, she was introduced by her three daughters, who let us know that their mother, who speaks very well in public, was initially so nervous about speaking in public that she took a comedy club class or something to learn how to speak. And so it was quite good. I will, going back to the original discussion about so much national attention to Wes Moore, the Baltimore Sun this week said, "Will Wes Moore resist the siren song of national politics and buckle down and really do some things in the state of Maryland?" You would think he would. He's smart enough to know that, I think.
But it's interesting, Tom, when when the invitations to be on the Today Show and CNN and all those things come, as they inevitably will, what's the right move if you're Wes Moore? Do you do some of that stuff to help build your brand and talk about the issues you care about, knowing that if there's a crisis or a scandal at home, it's very easy to criticize someone as not being attentive to the job they were elected to do? Or do you just set all of that aside and focus purely on being governor? I think it's a fascinating decision that he and his team will have going forward.
Well, his two predecessors as black governor, Deval Patrick, and in Virginia, Douglas Wilder, did not move on to take any national post. But since we're talking about a historic inauguration, I thought we'd play a clip of Doug Wilder's inauguration.
The opposition and oppression can be lifted, that discrimination can be eliminated, that poverty need not be binding, that disability can be overcome, and that the offer of opportunity in a free society carries with it the responsibility of hard work, the rejection of drugs and other false highs, and a willingness to work with others, whatever their color or national origin.
That was way back in 1990. I was there for that occasion.
Yes, he was elected in 89. And, you know, we had hoped to have him briefly on the show today to talk about what's happened in Maryland. We were unable to make that happen maybe another time. But it's a really important thing. I mean, Bruce mentioned that you mentioned the two governors in modern times. The only other two black governors were in the Civil War era in Louisiana, yep, who had tortured histories.
And Reconstruction got rid of all of that. Morse first
and
asked... go ahead, please.
And how sobering is it that 33 years after Doug Wilder made the remarks that you just played, Kodjo, every issue that he ticked off on his list is still a front burner for us today as a society. So that's some perspective at a minimum.
What will you be keeping your eye on during Moore's first few months in office? What challenges do you think he'll face?
Well, just to be catty for a moment, I think being on time. People want a piece of Wes Moore. He has, wherever he goes, people want to touch him, and he wants to touch them. He's a very huggy guy who has a lot of charisma, who makes connections with others easily. And his schedule on Thursday was insane. The number of meetings and media opportunities, it was almost laughable how many things they crammed into that first day schedule. Maybe they were tired of hearing Tom complain that he hadn't done anything yet. I don't know. But schedule management is as superficial as it sounds, and it is superficial, but that's going to be an enormous challenge. He has a little bit of a reputation for running late. He kept Steny Hoyer waiting 25 minutes the day Mr. Hoyer bestowed his endorsement upon Wes Moore during the primary. So I think schedule management is going to be a big, big challenge. But,
well,
but to the bigger politics, he's got almost the entire General Assembly invested in his success.
But as Tom Sher would like to say, this is the politics hour. So let's look ahead to the next election. Moore and Aruna Miller raised more than $17 million for their campaign, including $250,000 between the election and the inauguration. Put that in context for that. What does that say about their fundraising savvy and their intention to look ahead to the next race already?
It's a lot of money. It's a very good down payment on a re-election battle that it's hard to imagine a primary challenge of any note. And the Republican Party right now is in Maryland is in total disarray, leaderless and on its heels. So you don't want to get too far out over your skis, but he's going to have a lot of money.
That's why I'm sure he'll get the last
being
minute.
Lieutenant governor is not necessarily a highway to being governor. The current attorney general discovered that, Anthony Brown. Any thoughts about Anthony Brown being the attorney general? Brooke Learman is the controller. The entire state now is Democratic. Larry Hogan is gone. He's off on his whatever he's going to be doing. The entire state is Democratic. That's a very high perch from which to fall if things don't happen.
30 seconds, Bruce.
An enormous generational shift has just taken place. A lot of 70-somethings have moved on. Younger people have come in behind them. Diversity like Maryland has never seen before.
Yeah, the only 70-somethings who will never move on is Tom and yours truly. Bruce DePoit is a freelance reporter for Maryland Matters. Bruce DePoit, thank you very much for joining us. And don't say farewell again, because who knows, you'll probably pop up again.
Read
Take
the
care,
budget.
Doctor.
It's
Thank
really
you.
Interesting. I've been looking at it since we've been talking.
Any big plans this weekend, Sherwood?
Apparently, I'm going to be reading this budget.
Oh, yeah, and that'll take more than this weekend. You all, thank you for listening, and stay safe. I'm Kodjo Nnamdi.
The Politics Hour with Kodjo Nnamdi is produced by Sydney Grannan. Our managing producer is Ingalisa Schrobsdorf. Our engineering team this week was Kenny Pirog and Adrian Danhauser. And our phone screener was Ruth Secular. Tom Hudson oversees all the content we make at WAMU. For past shows, visit thepoliticshour.org.